regarded him, her eyes limpid, her pretty face serene. She gave him just the faintest shake of her head and moved ahead of him to embrace her fate. She almost glided, diaphanous and pure, her defiance a rod of adamantium running through her.
"I am Sister Celestia of the Order of the Silver Lantern," she declared. "I am the Emperor's daughter, and in him..."
A heavy blow sent her to her knees, and Christo cried out, ready to surge forward, until Celestia's shaking hand stopped him. She rose groggily to her feet, a jagged cut across her forehead bleeding into her eye, and confronted the acolyte, who trembled with rage and fear. There was always fear in the violent.
"And in him do I place my faith. I am his instrument, his sainted sword."
"You're a dead girl, is what you are," promised the acolyte,
backed up by her fellow cultists. Celestia remained undaunted.
"I denounce you," she said. "I denounce these foul works. I denounce you," she cried.
And at this, the acolyte appeared to pale. Whether the sister novice's vehemence had made an impression, or something else stayed the thug's hand, the next blow did not fall. For a fleeting moment, Christo dared to believe that Celestia had somehow got through to the mob, that her true faith had returned a measure of their sanity. It was not to be. Convocation appeared at the head of the aggressors. He gutted the acolyte with Vanquish, prompting a cry of anguish and anger from Celestia. Then, as the woman lay bleeding on the ground, he struck the sister novice across the head with the hilt, a blow savage enough to render her half unconscious. The priest was breathing hard behind his mask, like a dog left too long in the sun, trying to marshal his anger in the wake of violence. His gaze went first to Celestia, her crumpled body lying at his feet like a discarded doll, before alighting on Christo. A glimmer of something hungry and sadistic flashed across his eyes.
"Take them both," he ordered. "Judgment awaits."
They had to drag Christo. It took four men, the screams of his daughter ringing in his ears with every resisted step. He was ushered before one of the lecterns, a cosh to the back of his head to make him compliant. Convocation presided, his gaze imperious as he looked down upon them both.
"Righteous are the just," he began, "who do not shirk from the Emperor's light. False prophets have no purchase here, nor do heretics, or the followers of aberrant faith."
Celestia was pushed forward. Her hands were bound, and she stumbled.
"Unbelievers shall be cleansed, purged from the Emperor's sight."
She squirmed, her anger muffled by a gag tied around her mouth. It bit deep, the edges of her lip sore and bleeding as it chafed her.
"Please,"
Christo slurred, skull throbbing from the blow to the back of his head. A cultist either side held his arms, their attention on their priest.
"Please," he said again. "Put me in the cage. I am a fallen man," he declaimed. "I have killed. I am not righteous. I deserve punishment. Take me instead."
Convocation's ire had its focus now and would not be swayed. At a subtle gesture, a thug smacked Christo across the stomach, winding him. He stooped, gasping for breath. He saw Celestia looking back, saw all her youth betrayed in the tears running down her face, in the soft weeping stifled by the gag, in the trembling of her limbs.
"You are condemned," decried the priest,
seizing upon the edges of the lectern as he leaned forwards.
"You are condemned. Do you seek redemption?"
he asked. Celestia blinked, suddenly confused. She tried to look at Christo, but a rough hand on the back of her neck thrust her face forward at convocation.
"Remove it," snapped the priest. "Let the condemned speak. Let her confess to sin, so that we might all hear it."
The gag was removed, a painful wince on Celestia's face, making Christo's fists clench in impotent fury. He felt the grip of his captors lessen as religious fervour stole upon them, an incoherent baying erupting from the entire flock.
I...
Celestia struggled to form words, every effort to speak rewarded with pain. Convocation grew impatient, demanding,
"Do you seek redemption?"
I...
A bead of ruby blood trickled down her chin and dripped on her bare feet.
"I do."
Convocation leaned back, satisfied with his work. He was about to sermonise when Celestia interrupted.
"As do all of his true servants," she said. "Those who lead imperfect lives. I seek it in my every deed, just as I seek it now, as I denounce your heresy."
She scowled.
"False priest! Zealot!"
Silence fell. The baying voices faded to a shocked murmur. Convocation did not react at first, his mask impassive. He took a shuddering breath, made the holy sign of the Aquila over his chest, and then calmly pronounced judgment.
"Take her to the cage, where she shall burn for her sins."
The chain creaked ominously as the cage came down, the old links corroded and black. At first, she did not struggle. But as they took her to the edge of the gantry and lowered the cage to her, in which she would be interred, Celestia fought. She cried and punched and kicked. Christo fought too, but the gun pressed to the back of his neck soon quieted his outward quarrel.
"Take me,"
he whispered, shedding tears of his own as he watched Celestia thrust into the cage and the door slammed and sealed behind her.
"Take me."
She stared dumbly, as if resigned to her fate. A dousing of skin and cloth commenced, the reek of petrochem astringent in the church's cold air. A torch was lit, the crackle of wood and flame like savage laughter.
"Take me,"
Christo wept, the zealots deaf to his pleas. And despite all of her courage, Celestia screamed as they burned her body. The baying returned, louder and more guttural than before. Men had become beasts, and they each turned their faces to the fire, basking in its dark glow. Christo bowed his head, feeling the presence of the noose, the burden of all his sins pulling him down. He thought of Corinna, standing in the crowd, of her watching, as he did nothing. He raised his gaze and found his daughter's eyes in turn. She bellowed, her face twisted in anger and fear.
"Father!"
The fire blazed, mere moments old, the silhouette of a girl writhing inside it, her hair and clothes aflame, an endless scream as the cage slowly rose up on its protesting chain.
"Father!"
Corinna roared, louder than the mob, louder than the wailing crowds.
"Give her mercy!"
"Stay alive, Corinna. Stay alive."
One last look at his daughter, imprinting her image on his mind like a photograph, and Christo surged to his feet. He threw off the guards, near delirious in their sadistic revels, and lunged for convocation. The priest had turned to exult his flock, arms outstretched, as if in benediction. An inkling of disquiet had him look over his shoulder at the burly bullet maker bearing down upon him. He raised his pistol, and Christo felt the shot sting as it entered his body, but by then he was leaping and tackling Convocation off his feet, the pair of them crashing into the fiery cage as it was still rising, a shriek of metal, and the chain snapped. The cage, Christo, and the priest fell burning into the abyss.
Chapter 27. Arteries.
They entered the tunnels through an old outflow, wading through brackish water riddled with the corpses of vermin. A vast network, like arteries in a body, threaded through low sinks, grimy underhive, and beyond. The air stank here, cloying with sewer heat and the backwash of huge subterranean generators. The mechanisms were ancient, as large as landed starships, and droned like the voice of some primordial spirit of the deep earth. Morgravia didn't believe in such fancies. She didn't need wild stories to convince her of the uncanny. She knew it existed. Only her experiences were not some romanticized folk tale. They were blood and horror and the death of worlds. This she knew, ingrained. The price of her profession. Know the secrets, harbour the secrets, learn to live with them. Insanity, death, or damnation rewarded those who could not. She wondered which she would succumb to first. Perhaps she already had. The itch in her flesh had abated at least, but not gone away entirely, like a creature slumbering, dormant until roused again. She had followed Hell into the maw of the outflow, old memories churning of poor Oshanti dying with his back to the wall and two bullets in his gun. Morgravia grimaced at the thought and the fate she had condemned him to. As her sodium lamp parted the darkness, she knew these were not the same tunnels, but almost certainly a part of the greater network, a tributary. Did the cult operate here? She could not remember, only that they felt familiar. "Why are we here, Hell?" Morgravia asked. Hell roved ahead, ankle deep in silty runoff, though she made little sound as she slid through the murk. Pale cadavers bobbed in the turgid water like driftwood, bloated by putrefaction, with teeth rotted to black stumps and cavernous sockets for eyes. Many were too large and too humanoid to be vermin.
"As the plague worsened, they grew complacent," she said, neither turning nor slowing. "I waited, a rook upon my perch. The pallid did not bother me there. I can be still when I wish to be, as still as the dead. I watched, and eventually they revealed themselves, seeking openly in the dank and the dark, in the forgotten places."
Morgravia did not dwell on the unsettling nature of that. "In this underworld?"
"Yes. Cold, red eyes," Hell went on. "Blades for limbs and metal-bodied. Stalkers. Machine killers. Like me. They sent them to find it. I found it first."
The encounter before they had reached the precinct house returned to Morgravia in lurid technicolor. Chime, scrape, chime, scrape. The butcher's song. Hate red. Morgravia shut her eyes hard, banishing the image. "You are not a machine, Hell." The assassin stopped, head cocked slightly to the side.
"Am I not a tool, though, Mother? Fashioned for a specific purpose? A machine, by any other name?"
Morgravia remembered saying those words as Hell was uttering them. A pang of regret weighed heavy. "You are a servant of the Emperor," she said, uplifted.
"And am I good?"
"In his eyes and mine, you are righteous."
"And have I always been this way?"
"You are as the Emperor made you." Hell seemed to consider that.
"I am sorry I took so long to find you, Mother," she said,
carrying on.
"The world below is larger than I realised and has sharp teeth."
Morgravia glanced at the shadows, wondering what they harboured and what all of this portended. The return to equilibrium was slow, arduous. Without all of her memories, she felt naked, unarmoured. "None of that matters now," she murmured. Thoughts returning to the parasite churning within, and to whether or not Hell would have to kill her before it tore loose.
Take me to what you have found. She looked up at a curved ceiling, its low arches glistening with condensation, like a ribcage of wet bone. It led onto the darkness, a whispering cavern of half-heard voices and penumbral stirrings. Something brushed against her boot, and Mulgravia glanced down. It was a jawbone, drifting on a scum of black ash. Other bones swam with it. A finger, a piece of skull, a fragment of pelvis. A littering of the macabre. A floating declaration of mass murder. Hel saw it too, and drew her sword with a rasp of steel against leather.
Nearly there now, she said.
A memory intruded, of a little girl standing before a temple, her name surrendered to duty, of the scent of rain, of a door closing in her wake, and the silent tears that followed. Chapter 28. The Abyss. A savage hiss echoed through the cavern as the cage hit the water, smoke and steam pluming. Christo plunged into darkness, cold and suffocating. He tasted ash, the brackish water filling his nose and mouth. A deep lagoon beneath the pit, a sump of sewage and chemical waste. Skin stinging, heart burning in his chest, a heavy throb in his skull as he began to drown. Fierce panic, then slow calm. Christo kicked and flailed and broke the surface. A huge, painful wrench of air filled his lungs. The stench worsened. He gasped, half drowned upon the bank, aching with the effort of survival, and turned and dived back in. Blackness, a crushing closeness, and the terror of never again seeing the light edged in. He denied it, denied the fear and the paralysis. He swam down and down, reaching with outstretched fingers, pawing at the fathomless dark as pieces of old bone brushed against him. He felt metal, coarse and pitted. The cage. Blind, he quickly traversed the edge, bars used as handholds until he found the gate. It opened stiffly, dragging on filth and against the grimy water. A hand reached for his, and he took it firmly, pulling her into his embrace, this half-dead thing, and kicked like hell for the light. Coughing up black water and ash, Christo grasped at the bank. He hardly dared look at Celestia, who breathed raggedly, her skin a mess of red raw burns. She shivered on her back, trembling at the pain. Gently, Christo took her into his arms and out of the sump. A cavernous tunnel presented itself, a vaulted chamber with rib-boned arches stretching off into the distance. He put Celestia down on a raised stone lip. She looked small and shriveled, a candle worn almost to its wick. He cast around for a way out and found the priest. Convocation lay slumped against the bank, his neck twisted at an unnatural angle and evidently broken. He still had the ceremonial sword lashed to his belt. Christo took it, drawing it reverently. Celestia's eyes followed him, alighting on the sword as he placed it softly into her trembling grasp.
"You are,"
rasped Celestia, her lips burned away to blackened gums and teeth, her once beautiful golden hair reduced to ash-white threads plastered to her skull.
"A good man."
She pulled Vanquish to her chest, her arms brittle as charcoal and dark as overcooked meat. The skin flaked, red beneath the black, sore and agonized. She shut her eyes, and abruptly, the trembling ceased. Christo buckled, dropping to his knees as he wept. Another senseless death, when he had survived to suffer on. He sank down into a different abyss entirely, and would not have come up but for the tingling in his skull. It began as a pinprick, then turned into knives, stabbing.
He lurched, vomited, red pain thundering, black oblivion threatening at the edge of sight. The presence, he had felt. It called to him, and, powerless to resist, he followed its keening. Corinna clamped her jaw shut for fear of what pain and anguish she would allow in if she didn't. Her father had gone, leapt into the darkness, trailing fire, and the priest had gone with him. A dumbfounded silence stole across the divine, a flock without its shepherd. Afraid and disorientated, they looked at each other, and then the pit. One man pulled off his mask, slow and lingering, like tearing away false flesh. Another sagged to her haunches, an axe lying at her feet where she had dropped it. Convocation had indoctrinated them so thoroughly that in his absence, without his will to puppet them, they were empty, their animus draining like poison from a wound.
"Let us out,"
Corinna uttered to one of the guards. He turned, dumbly.
"Let us out,"
Corinna repeated, gesturing to the keys on his belt.
"Just hand me the keys. It'll be easy. And then you can leave. We can all leave."
Leave? He asked. "Leave where?"
"Anywhere."
She felt the anticipation of the others in the pens, watching and waiting, their fate depending on the outcome of this moment.
"Hand me the keys."
The guard took them off his belt and held them up. Carefully, Corinna stretched through the gate of the pen and took the keys. She watched the guard as she turned the lock, felt the satisfying clack. The gate opened and she stepped through it.
"Thank you,"
she said, then ripped the guard's knife from his belt and slashed his throat. Blood spray anointed her and anyone nearby. The guard crumpled, gurgling, dying. His death turned a mental lever. The prisoners broke from the pen and savagely fell upon their captors, stabbing, punching, kicking. The violence worsened, and Corinna knew instinctively that this wasn't just the outpouring of pent-up fear. It felt like a low throb in her skull, a migraine waiting to bloom and spread its cold grey agony. Corinna clutched her head, as if holding it might prevent her skull from cracking open. She had felt this before, at the gully, when the Death Kings and the Red Hands had slaughtered each other. Weaker then, not as intense. She looked around, the knife still in her bloody fist, and saw madness, tearing, pummeling, and killing. A few retained their sagacity. They screamed. A man was borne down, his arms and legs pinned as a rabid pack opened up his stomach with knives and teeth and pieces of glass. A clawed hand delved, and she saw the man's expression change to choked, excruciating pain, and then disbelief, as the glistening rope of intestine was pulled forth and stuffed in hungry mouths. It didn't end there. Soft, red meat remained within, and the pack yearned for it. Corinna, teeth clenched, needles of fire splitting her skull, fled for the gate. And overhead, through the fog of agony, she heard engine drone. Low and throaty, it trembled the ground. A shadow grew above her, descending as an actinic charge crackled the air. Christo staggered, sloshing through the murky brine, letting bits of corpses slap against his legs. He moved in a daze, wearing a perpetual grimace. He travelled downwards, through a crack in a cistern wall. Older here, the architecture was archaic, the cistern expansive and long since polluted and drained. The keening drew him on like an invisible thread tethered to his neck, gently pulling. Darker here, colder, a place light had not touched in centuries or more. Musty air made him choke and cough, but he persisted. He felt with his hands, took careful steps. Chillstone, gelid to the touch, echoed every sound back like a conversation. And then he stopped, a tiny shaft of light directing his eye to the middle of a great room. He wondered how far down it was from the church and reasoned it could not be that deep. Columns, some broken, others miraculously standing, delineated a frescoed square. Rubble had fallen. It might have been eons old, and cracks gaped in the stone like jagged grins. A casket, no, a sarcophagus, lay at the heart of the room. Old pipes, the rubber perished and begrimed, coiled from its sides. A filthy patina turned the brass green and fetid. Wires trailed like intestines, some frayed, others lost to the dark. The grainy shaft limned the edges of the sarcophagus, dust motes spiralling at his disturbance. Christo approached and saw a hand reaching from the broken lid, its fingers outstretched as if trying to touch the light. Mimicking the gesture, he went to touch it. The keening made resistance impossible, and like a sprung trap, the hand snapped over his. He recoiled on instinct, but the hand felt cool and shone with gunmetal luster. A cybernetic, a machine. It clenched harder, and now he felt true fear. Then pain, as the bones in his fingers snapped like twigs. A muted cry struggled from his open mouth before a metal, tentacular thing inserted itself within. Christo gagged but couldn't spit it out, his free hand wrenching at the prehensile appendage squirming down his throat. He shook, nerves misfiring. The hand clenched tighter, and his bones were reduced to powder, eliciting a strangled whimper. And the keening went on, and the presence imposed itself, filling him. It consumed and usurped, a consciousness in need of a shell. His mind, its mind, draining marrow and blood, the agony of every fresh violation like liquid fire through his nerve endings. He felt its will, its desire, its need, as it spread and overwrote. It wasn't enough. The invasion stalled. The slow absorption reversed. The tentacle retracted, and like an organ incompatible for its host, it rejected him. A discarded shell remained, half cracked and bloody on the inside. A soft and boneless thing that had once been a man. Christo lived long enough to see the face of death coming for him out of the darkness. And then there was the black and... Hel held her sword to the pile of offal and sloughed skin that had presumably once been a man. It quivered in its death throes and fell still, steaming and broken, like a butcher's leavings. "Stay back," warned Morgravia, one eye on the sarcophagus as she shone a light upon it.
"This is it,"
said Hel, poised, her blade high and ready to strike.
"This is what they were seeking, Mother."
A tentacle slid back into the hollows, slithering away like a worm afraid of the light.
"I'm not your..."
Morgravia stopped, mid-sentence. A voice echoed in her mind. A mewling, whining need.
"I am afraid," it said. "I am dying,"
it said, though in no language that could be spoken. It had to be passed, processed. Meaning was formula, equation. It was the same language as in the red dream, of the machine surgeons as they had her on their slab, dissecting and experimenting. The Magi of the Valgast.
"I need you,"
it said. An impulse, a piece of clever cognition bound up in machine code.
"I love you,"
it said. The wrongness of it made Morgravia recoil and shrink back from the old remembrance it provoked.
The girl,
as she had turned to face the door, her eyes burgeoning with tears, her fear, her love, not knowing she would be remade, that they would take away her fear and replace it with something cold and unfeeling. Mulgravia had been grateful for the rain when it came. It made hiding her sorrow easier. Memory gave way to reality. "Hel, stay back," she said, retreating. A parental instinct, an old feeling of disquiet before the veil fell and horror was revealed. The dust motes froze, glinting like dying fireflies in the light. A charge lit the air, crackling like static, the scent of ozone and heat. Mulgravia blinked, suddenly surrounded. The cult of Valgast were here. Chapter 29. The Monster Inside. Clad in dark robes, the sigil of the cog and star conjoined stitched into the fabric. They encircled Hel and Mulgravia like a flock of patient ravens.
"Shall I kill them, Mother?"
A chuckle, mechanistic, but dripping with derision. Seven voices spoke as one, their hoods hiding their faces, and only the faint glow of blood red beneath, betraying their cybernetic natures.
"You are undone," they said.
Hel raised her sword a fraction, but Mulgravia lifted a hand in warning. At the periphery she saw them, hate-red eyes, blades for limbs. The Magi had not come alone. As they closed, details were revealed. Mutations, the curl and twist of the unnatural. Arcane devices carved into metal. Aberrant biology and flesh. Bestial limbs, a serpentine tail, rot and rust upon one, a cloying, soporific musk on another. Furnace heat, the coppery reek of slaughter, mirrored facets instead of a face, colours iridescent and ever-changing.
"You are the Valgast?" said Mulgravia, her pistol drawn but held low.
One of their number nodded. An eighth spoke to the cult's wheel. Tall and thin, its robes draping something skeletal. She saw metal, a plate riveted across its mouth to mute it. Runes had been fashioned into the plate, sickening to look at. It closed on her, raising its head with the whirring of servos and gears. Light flared, two red suns looming, and inwardly Mulgravia quailed. She knew this monster, the Magos who had presided over her unmaking. Her skin itched, the monster stirring within. Hel tensed, eager for violence. Exactly as she had been made, her childhood sacrificed to turn her into a weapon.
"Mother?"
Mulgravia was shaking her head. "Don't." She had been here before. Captured, eviscerated, unmade. Hel had rescued her, not knowing what she had done. The signal unleashed. It was inside her. It had to end. There was no other way. She took her pistol and rammed it under her chin. "I'll do it," she swore. "Too many have died. But if it takes one more to stop it, then so be it."
"It will accomplish nothing," uttered the seven voices. And somehow Mulgravia realised it wasn't seven, but one. It was him, their muted lord, the hub of the wheel, who spoke through them.
"I disagree," Mulgravia replied, though she felt Hel's uncertainty mirrored by her own.
"I will sever the signal from its source."
"You mistake your purpose. Let us teach you."
A vice of agony exerted itself upon her, and she struggled to hold on to the pistol. She glanced at Hel, wanting to reach out, but she stood perfectly still, her sword now lowered,
arms by her sides. Hel had rescued her. Afraid, disorientated, Morgravia had fled. Oshanti had led them through the tunnels, having cut her free. They had made a breach. Carnegie was dead. Roper, too. He looked shaken. He asked about Hel, but Morgravia didn't know. She barely knew her own name back then. Hel had rescued her. She had stayed behind, luring them away, fighting. How long had it taken her to find her? It felt like hours, but it could have been days. She recalled the words she had spoken to Hel back in her hab. "They're waiting," she had said, "for me to remember." And now she did.
"And so you are enlightened," said the seven voices.
The pain eased. Morgravia lowered the pistol from her chin, tears in her eyes as she regarded Hel.
"You never escaped.
You let us go."
"As I said, you mistake your purpose."
"It's not within me. It's her. She is the signal." Hel, as if she had been paused and now resumed, turned.
"Mother, shall I kill them now?"
Morgravia raised her pistol and fired.
"Yes, daughter," she gasped,
tears streaming as the weapon slipped from her grasp. Hel collapsed, a gaping hole in her chest. Her eyes met her mother's, and Morgravia held them like she wanted to hold her. They clung to each other like that, staring, holding on, trying to grasp a sliver of a life not lived, a life that had ended as soon as the doors to the temple had closed.
"And then you can sleep."
"It changes nothing," said the seven voices. "You mistake your purpose."
"You mistake your reach," snapped Morgravia, heart clenched by grief but still defiant, straining as the monster within uncoiled, slowly waking. "It won't end with me. The Inquisition will find you. They will burn your grubby cult to ash. Valgast is but another heretic footnote in the Great War."
"You are as willfully ill-informed as you are insignificant. Valgast is not a cult. It is beyond your mortal comprehension. It is the unpinning of the universe. It is the grand unmaking. We are but humble servants, gratefully beholden to its will and majesty. You speak of burning cults as if this will end it. You have no say in this. You do not know what this is."
Morgravia's eyes flicked to the sarcophagus, to the childlike hand reaching from its shattered lid, and the tendrils slowly eking from its dark confines.
"It is the simulacrum. It is older than ages, a relic from before. It is sentience in the machine, the apogee of aspiration. You have been remade for it, the perfect incubator. That is your purpose, and now you shall fulfill it."
And it was dying, Morgravia realized. Whatever dark technologies had preserved the simulacrum had begun to fail. She was to be its vessel, a host fashioned so it might endure, nourished by her machine body. Hel had brought her here willingly, but unwittingly, another pawn in the game. Hel, scraped clean of her humanity, a killer without a face, a daughter laid upon the sacrificial slab of the Imperium. Death by any other name. And now she had suffered another, her final death. Morgravia felt it scratching at the core of her, aching to be unleashed, the monster inside.
"Let it."
The rage and grief spilled out of her, skin unstitching, limbs distending. She became blades and churning teeth and whips of razored metal, lashing, unmade, remade.
Shouts in the machine language of the cult suggested panic. She had already eviscerated two without thinking, her flesh face dappled with oil and blood. Their parts lay scattered, perfectly, brutally dissected, offal and scrap. The stalkers lunged for her, cantering out of the shadows to the defence of their black-robed masters, hacking and cutting. Morgravia flung herself in a whir of teeth and blades. She bifurcated, eviscerated, decapitated, cleaved and severed, tore and wrenched, an orgy of violence, sickening and satisfying in its application. The monster, well-fed, but far from sated. The last of the stalkers slid off her bladed limb, impaled. The machine light died in its single eye. She did not slow nor consider. Humanity faded. An overexposed image turned to white. Whatever she had become, whatever they had made her, it was no longer human. Arachnoid, insectile, she sprang onto the cult, stabbing with the mandibles unfurled from an overstretched jaw. She tasted them as they died, their oily plasma, the gelatinous fluids pumping like ichor through their bodies. She drank of it, revelled in it, slashing and hunting and gorging herself until only two remained. "It is inexorable," said the seven voices, that now were one. "Nothing you do here will stop it." She speared the voice, slitting it down the middle and leaving the two halves sparking and spewing in a shivering heap. Then she met the gaze of the last, the leader. He seemed untroubled when she took his head. A single snip, paired blades scissoring his machine neck. Black sludge gushed from the wound, corroding and dissolving. Morgravia sank down and felt her flesh re-knitting, her limbs retracting. Pain, abject, and magnesium bright, suffused her like acid. She shuddered, howling her anguish, screaming it over and over, until at last the resonance of her agony faded, and she was left, silent and alone. Naked, but for the scraps that remained, she hobbled over to the sarcophagus. The tendrils reached for her as she closed, a neonate grasping for its mother's sustenance. It lay within the simulacrum. A face, beatific, infantile, gave expression to a tentacled abomination. A slithering accumulation of malign and prescribed science. It felt. And as Morgravia looked upon it, as its tendrils gently but purposefully wrapped themselves around her, she realised it did not want to die, that it would do anything to live, kill anyone to perpetuate.
"I love you," it said,
that cold, alien presence intruding, persuading.
"I love you, Mother."
Morgravia stiffened, her lip curling.
"I'm not your fucking mother," she uttered,
her pistol against the simulacrum's tiny forehead as its tendrils squeezed desperately. A loud boom resounded, emphasised by the confines of the sarcophagus. The tendrils slackened, letting Morgravia slide away. She slumped down, her back against the sarcophagus. A pistol lay in her hands, heavy with purpose. One bullet remained. She crawled across the pieces of bodies and the machine wreckage, through spilled blood and oil, to reach her. Hell. Trembling, she took off her mask and found a girl behind it. Pale skin, eyes like fiery amber, her hair shaved, but still a girl. Her girl. "Now, we end it." Morgravia touched a hand to Hell's cheek, pressed the gun against her own left temple, and spent the last bullet.
Chapter 30.
Survivors. They got almost half a mile away from the gate when Barak decided to turn back. Jaina didn't argue or even object. Still weak, still pale, he reversed the rig and headed south, to the church, to Morgravia. He drove in silence, Jaina loading up the shotguns as he hammered the accelerator. 200 feet away, and he saw the girl. Thought it an apparition at first, a symptom of his injuries. It was only when Jaina yelled at him to stop that he pumped the brake and slewed the mule to an ungainly halt. She stood there, half lit by the forward lamps, a young female ganger, scared, alone, needing help. Jaina stepped out, a shotgun slung across her back.
I don't...
The girl grimaced, running a hand through her hair, looking this way and that.
I don't know where I am.
She wrung her hands, wet her lips.
They were killing each other, eating each...
She trailed off, her face turning blank.
Oh, throne.
It's all right, said Jaina, holding out her hand. It's all right. You're not alone. Come with us. We'll help you.
She edged closer.
But you need to put that down.
The girl frowned, eyes glazing as she regarded the bloody knife in her hand. Her arm was slick. It glistened tackily in the light.
I must have,
she said, touching the base of her neck.
Come with me now, said Jaina. You don't need that anymore. Come with me, and you'll be safe.
She smiled.
What's your name?
My name?
The girl looked around, as if searching for the answer.
Corinna,
she said at last.
I'm Corinna.
I'm Jaina, said Jaina. And this is my husband, Barak.
Barak? My father knew a man by that name.
Barak had stepped out of the rig, and his eyes narrowed as he recognised the girl and the young woman before him.
Corinna, he said, disbelieving. You're Christo's daughter.
Corinna wept, nodding. She let go of the knife, and Jaina embraced her, held her long enough that she could stop crying. They didn't head any further south. Nothing left there, Corinna told them. Nothing but the dead. The gate remained sealed as they approached it, the rig giving its last dying breaths. Its engine failed at the edge of the long processional leading to Hive Edge. Bodies burned on either side of it, some contorted by the plague, others simply corpses. Barak found it hard to count, to even fathom. He led his wife and the girl through the fields of the dead, past cleansing crews in proctor garb. As they reached the gate, looking up upon the vast and indomitable edifice, he saw evidence of a vicious battle for the ramparts. A watchman speaking through a loud hailer addressed him, demanded they turn back. Uphive was sealed until further notice. Containment, he said. Plague, he said. Weapons edged from murder slits, anonymous and deadly. Barak held up the rosette Morgravia had given him, a spark of grief lighting within at the thought of her as he raised it, for surely she must be dead. A scope peered down. Seconds passed, freighted with the possibility of imminent execution. He heard shouted orders, hurrying feet. The weapons retracted. The gate to Uphive opened. 2 years later. The ship was coming, and throughout Low Sink, bells rang in celebration. A landing field had been prepared near Hive Edge, overlooking the Irin Mir, and the old ruin where a priory had once stood. A blackened spur of rock stood there now, a sapling having taken root in the rich soil left in its wake. Corinna stood, shoulders back, her face tilted to the sky as she watched for the lander. She had a knapsack slung across her back, a knife in her belt that she hoped they'd let her keep, rugged clothes and a heavy coat that Barak had given her. He and Jaina stood nearby, proud as parents, already missing the daughter they never had. Corinna had never told them what happened at the church. In truth, she remembered little after she had fled. There was a shadow, a ship suspended above her, and then she was in the street, wandering, alone and afraid. They had found her, and they had taken her in. She had found purpose, inspired by her father's example. She would give her life for something greater than herself. She had answered the tithe and would find her place amongst the stars as a soldier. She knew it would be hard, that the galaxy held terrors the recruitment parchments omitted. Death held no fear. Insignificance did. Rumbling the earth, engines growling as it made its descent, the lander came into view. Smog parted, pushed aside like waves before its mass and power. Fire lit the sky, muted and diffuse across the heavy cloud layer. A klaxon sounded, signalling for the recruits to advance onto the landing field. Corinna turned before she headed out, a smile and a wave for the man and woman she had come to trust and think of as her family. Both held back tears, clinging to one another, already wondering how they would fill their lives without her. A Munitorium officer approached her at the threshold of the landing field, one of an advance party here to ensure the tithe went smoothly and in an orderly fashion. "Name," he said, curtly, eyes on a data slate cinched in the crook of his elbow, a stylus in the other hand primed to write. "Corinna Christo." The officer ran through the names and made a face. "Not many from Blackgeist." Corinna stiffened as old, unpleasant memories intruded. The officer frowned then, rubbing at his temples. He looked suddenly ill, a vein throbbing in his neck like a cord of rope. Flushed, sweating, he appeared starved of breath. "Are you all right?" Corinna asked. It passed, whatever it was, a shadow, withered by the sun.
"It's nothing, just a headache."
He gave a watery smile and thrust a piece of parchment in her hands, stamped and approved for tithe.
"Must be the hive air," he said. "Never much cared for it."
Corinna smiled back. It was a tight, contained thing, almost cold.
"Neither have I," she said, and advanced onto the landing field.
That was Sepulturum, written by Nick Kine, read by Antonia Beamish. This recording is copyrighted to Games Workshop 2020.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.